answering your tough financial questions for the past 26 years. It's Allworth's Money Matters with co-hosts Scott Hansen and Pat McClain. Would you like an opinion on a financial matter you're dealing with? Whether it's about retirement, investments, taxes, or 401ks, Scott Hansen and Pat McClain would like to help you by answering your call. To join Allworth's Money Matters, call now at 833-99-WORTH. That's 833-99-W-O-R-T-H.
Welcome to Allworth's Money Matters. I'm Scott Hansen.
I'm Pat McClain.
Glad you're joining us today as we talk about money, financial issues, retirement planning, income strategies, all that good stuff, both myself and my co-host here. Both financial advisors, certified financial planner, chartered financial consultant. We spend our weekdays helping people plan their financial futures and manage their money. And this show is on the weekend to help you. We hope we are your financial advisors on the air. And I'd love to take your question, your calls, answer your questions. And
help you make good decisions. Yeah. Good money decisions.
Absolutely. That's kind of the goal here. Good financial choices.
Yes.
Good financial choices so you have choices in how you can live your life.
In now and in retirement.
Again, I saw this. I just read this the other day about the 40% of Americans couldn't come up with $400 to pay for
a needed car repair.
I saw
the same thing.
And medical expense. Well, if you go to the ER.
Well, that just, but Scott, they could come up with the money. They're just going to need to borrow it. They're going to get through that situation. They just couldn't come up with $400 out of pocket, but they're going to go to put it on a credit card or go to a payday lender or something along those lines.
And granted, you as a listener, you're probably not in that situation. Majority of our listeners are not. Obviously not in that situation. And some people are there, but it's no result of their own. And some people, it's a series of bad choices. Anyway, that's not the show. We're not really targeting the show to those people.
This is like, how do you convert an IRA to a Roth IRA? And that population is not super concerned about that. Actually why every time that they pass legislation that allows for, you know, low-income savers to put money into a state-sponsored IRA-type plan.
Well, the state has a sponsored IRA. So does the federal government.
You look at it and you think,
what's it even called?
I don't. Who's ever?
No one uses them. Yeah. I guarantee we spend more. The federal government program came out about 5 years ago. MyRA.
What it's called. Huh?
Maybe it was 3 or 4 years ago. MyRA. And I bet the federal government spends more to administer the program than they actually put into the people's accounts.
Yes. Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, there is.
And there's a tax credit if your income's below a certain amount. It's 50 cents on the dollar. It'll give you a match on IRA contributions. But the
population doesn't
have
that dollar.
It's the same people were talking about. They couldn't come up with $400.
So conceptually,
if they can
come
up with $5,000 to put in their IRA, then the government will match them 50 cents on the dollar.
But there's a disconnect oftentimes between government policy and reality.
Which we'll talk a little bit
later
about the student debt issues.
Student debt issues, are you kidding?
Well, it's going to be larger and larger topic in the presidential.
The people that actually have the student debt are all under the age of, most of them are under the age of 40.
30.
Most of them are under the age of 30.
Yeah.
So.
Anyway.
Let's take calls.
Yes,
let's
get
about our phone numbers and then let the calls rip in.
Rip in. Let's, to join the program, our contact number to be part of Allworth's Money Matters, and we are now Allworth Financial, no longer Hansen McClain, same Scott Hansen, same Pat McClain, Allworth Financial. The contact number is 1-833-99-WORTH. Toll-free 1-833-99-WORTH. Numerically, it's 833-999-6784.
And I want to make a point here too, our podcast listeners. If you have a question, regardless of when, you could call that number and they'll schedule a time for you to be on our show during our recording time. So we have, we believe we have almost as many podcast listeners as we do on
more.
Terrestrial radio. So if you call 833-99-WORTH with your question, they will schedule a time for you to be on the air, and you could listen to yourself on the podcast. And while you're doing listening to yourself on the podcast or listening to our podcast, if you'd be so inclined, if you could possibly rate us.
Yeah, give us a review, please.
Give us a review.
Let's go to Los Altos and talk with Mike. Mike, you're with Allworth's Money Matters.
Thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call.
Yeah.
Let me start by telling you a little bit about myself and my situation.
Perfect.
I'm a very frugal person, and I'm sure started from my parents. We're both teachers back in the day when those folks earned very little money. This was compounded by my earliest daily upbringing by my grandmother in whose home we were living, who had been through two world wars and a depression and had herself been the child of a widowed mother with six kids.
That'll do it.
So when I went to college, I always enjoyed technical matters. So I majored in math and physics and got an advanced degree in EE. I was recruited even before I graduated by Gene Amdahl for his new company and did pretty well in the corporate technical field. But I eventually decided to go out on my own and started my own engineering company in the computer area. But when I reached my early 50s, my parents began to have some pretty significant health issues, and Dad called and pleaded for me to come help since no one else in the family was interested in doing so. The problem was I was still pretty young, and realized that this commitment would likely result in my not being able to return to work as an engineer. So I consolidated my savings into more aggressive investments that would hopefully get me through the kind of forced early retirement through the rest of my life. So I was looking for very significant growth and didn't care about income since I had taxes on my home that would likely offset any income expectations that I had. This all went very well until the latest changes this year in the tax law, which I think you know about. And this year I was killed by taxes. I simply had too much dividend and mutual fund income, and I didn't need it because of my very simple lifestyle. I had several friends who had similar problems, and they were leaving California, and a couple had even left the United States. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to leave either place, and I realized, but I got to thinking about it, and I realized I could probably solve my problem by restructuring my investment portfolio. On April 15th, when for some reason this really hit home, I sold a ton of stuff. It was the low. I went through my portfolio and sold the lowest yielding assets with the. Which doesn't pay dividends and still has decent growth.
Repeat that last section. For some reason,
you cut out. Yeah. So what did you say? You sold the lowest yielding.
Yeah, portion of my portfolio that had basically very, very small tax consequence for selling because the basis was low.
So when you say lowest yielding.
This lowest yield, it was getting very little return on this stuff, but it was giving me a huge the return I was getting was coming in as extremely taxable.
So these were the lowest returning, but maybe had high distributions of dividends.
They were the highest. By lowest yield, I mean basically my basis had not increased in the 10 or 15, 20 years that
I
earned them.
Got it. Okay.
So I don't mean my basis.
You sold your losers.
Investment. Yeah. So I haven't finished. I did that with a bunch of money, several $100,000, but I'm still not finished with this rebalancing. I don't want to have only Berkshire Hathaway left in my portfolio. So I have two questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of this strategy? And do you have other investment ideas for good growth that don't produce income, I need to tell you one thing. My ultimate goal is for everything I own to go at my death to fund future students in physics and engineering and in the education in that field.
All right. That's so you expect 100% of your net worth to go to a charitable cause. Is that what you said?
You got it.
Okay. Don't sell another thing. How old are you?
I'm 71.
And what's the approximate size of the estate?
About around a little over, it's $10 million right now.
Okay. So here's what.
I'm going to back up one step before this. Oftentimes, we'll talk about, and other good financial planners will talk about, before we can answer an investment question, we really need to take a step back and say, what is the ultimate objective here?
What is the goals with the money?
Yes. So you told us about your problem, which is the tax issue, and now with the limitation of the SALT deductions, your tax bill went up, and it's really frustrating you and making you angry. And you're like, I got to restructure something, right? But then what you just told us is that the ultimate goal is when you pass on, whether it's 15 years from now or 30 years
or whatever the number is, what you want to be done with the dollars, which is therein lies the answer.
Yes. Right?
Therein lies the answer. So what are you living on now on an annual income that is being derived from this portfolio? So how much is, you said your net worth is $10 million. What is the size of the portfolio?
Three or four million. And it's probably well over $10 million, because the house is worth nearly 10.
And are you going to stay in that area for a while? How long do you plan to stay in the house?
Until they carry me out in a coffin, basically.
Okay. And how much income are you living on at a year?
Okay, I can live off my Social Security and the dividends from one stock.
And is that what you want to live on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Have you looked at doing anything like a charitable remainder trust,
or a life annuity, or a gift annuity?
I just talked to a financial advisor from the university, and he suggested something like that. I had talked to Fidelity, which is where it's my broker, and he suggested an annuity as well, but he
I ran away from that as fast as I possibly could.
I didn't call him back.
Yeah, the annuity I mentioned was called a gift annuity, which is different than the annuity that Fidelity.
Do not buy a commercial annuity. You're probably not going to get this kind of advice from your Fidelity representative.
So.
Yeah, that's why I didn't call him back.
Okay.
I would have pushed you into speaking with the university. The ultimate receivers of your charitable donation is where I would have started the conversation.
Is the plan for it to go to your alma mater?
Yeah.
It's even easier. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a couple different methods you could take here.
Let's explain the benefits to you in doing one of these two strategies, either a gift annuity through the university or a charitable remainder trust, or there's some other,
there's a few other little nuances. Or a combination of strategies.
But here's what you could do, Mike. Let's say your net worth is roughly $14 million. You could take a portion of that today. Let's say you took $1 million and did it a gift annuity or a charitable remainder trust. What that does, you're basically saying you're going to have what's left of this principal when I die, but during my lifetime, I'm getting the income from it. So I want you to have it, but only when I'm gone, because I need the income for my life, my lifestyle. When you do that, you receive a current charitable deduction. It's not of the full amount that you put in, because you're going to get some benefits from, but it's essentially the present value of that, what the what it'll be worth down the road when the beneficiary ultimately receives the asset upon your death. It gives you an immediate charitable deduction.
Which will cancel out.
Let's say you end up with a charitable deduction of a few hundred thousand dollars. I'm just throwing some numbers out. That gives you this great charitable deduction that gives you an opportunity to go back in the portfolio of those with gains that are spinning off high dividends and saying, now we have a chance to restructure these things. So you can gift a highly appreciated asset. You get a tax deduction based upon the current market value, not your cost basis in it. It's going to be discounted because of whether it's a gift annuity or a charitable remainder trust. But you are like the perfect candidate for this.
Because you have
textbook candidate.
Because you have charitable intent. What you've done is you kind of put the cart before the horse by actually rebalancing the portfolio before the strategy was in place.
But he only sold some of the stuff that was not a taxable event.
No, he said he did sell the taxable event.
About $300 of taxes from the sale.
Oh, got it. Yeah. I would start with the endowment office at the university. And more than that, Scott, I would actually look at, because you said your house is worth about $8 million, did you say?
$10 million?
$8 to $10 million.
Yeah, I would look to see if that was, because the...
You use some of that house and get a lesson sort of life estate on it.
A life estate on it. Because you don't care what happens to the house.
I talked to some people, they say anytime you change the title on your house, you get a reassessment.
Yeah, there would be that. So here's,
but that's the, not, but this, but that may not, it, it may not affect you at all.
Well, here's here's the bottom line. There's a number of different things that you could do that would solve the problem that you first brought up, the thing that's irking you. Right? You want to stay in California, and it's like it keeps getting worse in the tax situation for you.
Right? Yeah, amen.
Right? And you're like, come on. I'm not retiring. You just keep sucking it from me. And you want to leave it to the university, but...
You don't want to run out of money.
You don't want to run out. It's just like, you can have it when I'm done, but I don't know when I'm going to be done.
That's exactly the concern.
So what happens is you take a look at these assets, and you sit down and you say, okay, what is the most efficient tax strategy to get to those objectives? One is that I get a tax deduction to mitigate any of the gains that I have in my portfolio. The other is that they end up with those dollars. Or the third thing is that I stay in my house until my dying day. And you've got a number of assets that you'd look at in terms of which was the best ones to gift over to the university in some sort of either a life estate or what they call a gift annuity or a charitable remainder trust.
And I agree with Pat. I would start with the university. They all have planned giving experts.
They
work with estate planning attorneys.
Oftentimes, they'll pay for the estate planning and the financial planning on your behalf.
Yeah, I just talked to them this morning. Now, the thing that has me concerned is basically you don't get, when you say a tax deduction, I'm using the standard deduction, right? I've never used it in years, for decades, but I'm using it now because my property taxes are
if you have a huge charitable deduction
in 1 year and you rebalance the portfolio to go forward, then it changes.
They can
all
offset
that.
Each other, and then you could have additional charitable contributions going forward.
Yeah, you're not going to get the answers from two guys on a radio show
in 10 minutes.
In 10 minutes.
But here's what we know, Mike. There are several different techniques that could work wonders for you. And our recommendation to you is to talk to, let's start with the university, talk with one of their planning experts, and they can run scenarios for you. You're an engineer. Right. You want it all laid out, right? Let's look at the numbers.
You got it.
I totally get it. You want it all laid out. So if we took this strategy, here's what that would mean. If I were in your shoes, I would talk to two or three good estate planners and get two or three different opinions.
After the university will oftentimes pay for all of this, right?
Yep.
So
the university I think is really good. The problem I had was I started with Fidelity, which is the wrong place.
Wrong place. They're not. So if you were my client, I would actually accompany you to the university appointment.
And help you figure it out.
That's the way we would do it, right? It's hard for a financial advisor to say they want to do that because what the financial advisors get paid to manage money and they're telling someone else to take it. Right.
Right.
But a good financial advisor
doesn't care.
A good financial advisor understands what the objectives are for the client and will go to whatever means necessary,
Mike,
to get there.
Mike, I hate to say it, I'm actually pretty excited for you because I really believe there are some techniques that are going to, not only will they help you with this situation right now, you'll feel better about staying in California, but I think you'll feel really good about the steps that you've taken. And it's going to, you'll have a net increase financially for you, and
you might be even endow a position at the university now by doing this that you can feel proud of the rest of your life. Wouldn't it be great to say that you've endowed a position at the university?
Yeah, I've already got two on tap.
Wouldn't it be great if you endowed three, Mike? All right, appreciate
the
call.
Thanks for calling, and it's nice chat with you. But I love you. You know what I love about what I do for why I get up in the morning? I love
because I work just, with me.
No, I just meet lots of different people, interesting people.
Yeah, and this guy, he has no interest in changing his lifestyle. His money doesn't change him at all.
No, but he knows he's pretty clear on what he wants to see happen with
now,
it.
Now, for the rest of the listeners, he's saying, well, he lives in an $8 million house.
That's in Los Altos.
Right, and who knows? He's probably been in the same house.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Although he probably was making pretty good money to buy a house back.
Yeah,
in the
but
day.
It's not what you see the movie stars living in. I guarantee you.
Yeah, it's a nice house though.
But it's not the Taj Mahal by any means. It's Silicon Valley is so expensive. Our contact number 1-833-99-WORTH. We're Northern California with Kim. Kim, you're with Scott and Pat Allworth's Money Matters.
Hey there.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, this is great.
Good.
I heard your show on the 27th about rental properties, so that's why I'm calling.
All righty.
I bought this property. It actually was a 1031 exchange in 2003. I had inherited some acreage. We sold to a developer. And my uncle recommended doing a 1031 exchange for a home, so I didn't have to pay any taxes.
Okay.
Okay.
This is in 2003.
Yes.
Okay.
I've rented it this whole time. I've refinanced, borrowed money against it. So I owe $253,000. Oh, I'm sorry. I paid $253,000. I owe $230,000. I could probably sell it for about $360,000.
Got it. And what's your basis in it?
She doesn't know because it's super low.
Yep.
Yeah, my tax deferment, my uncle said, is anything over $15,000.
Okay. So it's all gain.
It's all gain.
Gain?
Okay, what's your question for us?
Well, my question is, I had hoarders in there 2 years ago, so I was just like, I want it out. Luckily, I've been renting to people that I know.
You know what the problem with hoarders, Kim? They never hoard good things. If I hear a hoarder that like hoarded jewelry,
rare coins,
stamps, you wouldn't complain.
Most
they just hoard
of it
bad
was trash.
Things. Yes. Right. So hoarding in and of itself isn't a bad thing.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh. Well, my question is, like, how can I get out of this? I can't. Selling would be a huge loss.
Why do you want to get out of it?
Right. Well, because I just don't want to manage it anymore.
I mean, one of the challenges here, to be real frank with you, Kim, is you've pulled $230,000 that you spent, and you haven't paid tax on the gain because it's all from a gain.
So if you sell this property, you're break even.
Best.
Or
it's nothing, essentially.
We're assuming
it's all
that
gain.
So you got
it's all gain.
Yeah, it's all gain. And then some maybe. Mm-hmm. You're right.
Where'd the money go on the refinance?
Well, let's see. I had about $10,000 worth of remodeling it after the hoarders. I used it to get myself through nursing school.
Oh, good.
Okay.
And
well,
some other bad decisions.
What do you think you should do?
Do you know if I could move into it for 2 years and then sell it as a primary resident?
That's actually not a bad idea.
I don't think.
Or could I buy another home?
That changed a year ago.
It changed.
I would talk to your tax. So the rules changed.
It used to be.
You could play that game.
But they changed the rules recently.
Oh, okay.
I would, but it's not a definitive no. I just don't recall what the change. There's so many tax changes a year ago that they don't.
Why just 2 years? Do you not like the house? Or where are you living now?
Oh, I love the house. I have a primary residence, and I actually borrowed money against that house too.
Okay.
I own my house outright that I'm in.
If you were my sister, I'd probably say, let's just figure out what your tax liability is, and if we can walk away and call it a wash,
then do
that's
so.
That's good.
Good enough.
Because our concern is that if you continue to hold this, you end up with some other problems. Suddenly you can't pay the mortgage on it. And then
roof needs replaced, whatever. So try to get away from this. And even if you had to take a little bit of cash out of your own primary residence to do so, I would do so.
Yeah, I think so. We got to take a quick break. Stick around for more of Allworth's Money Matters.
Can't get enough of Allworth's Money Matters? Visit allworthfinancial.com/radio to listen to the Money Matters podcast. Do you have a financial question that needs answering? Call us at 833-99-WORTH. That's 833-99-WORTH.
Welcome back to Allworth's Money Matters. I'm Scott Hansen.
I'm Pat McClain.
Glad you are sticking with our program and
listening to us.
It's always nice to have listeners.
Yes. And if you're listening by podcast, via podcast, we have recently, as you have noticed, changed our name to Allworth. And our marketing people have said, you know, people having a hard time finding our podcast. So they said, when you do this radio show / podcast, could you please promote people rating our podcast? So do so, please. We need your help.
Yes, just go to
wherever you...
I think most people do iTunes.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Unless you're an Android user.
Yeah, I don't associate with Android users, so...
My son's an Android user, and he's not welcome in my home.
Is that right?
Not quite.
Actually, my son is an Android user as well.
Well, my son, though, he's so frustrated, he says, I'm going to become an Apple user.
Because he can't communicate with other Apple
users?
No,
he has problems with the phone, and it's not the... I think it's just grass is greener. I think once it gets a...
Yeah, there we go. All right, so we take phone calls on this show. We don't just talk about our personal lives. We actually take your calls... Where you ask questions.
We just had, we spent the last half hour with calls. I think people realize that.
Well, maybe they just tuned in.
Okay.
Fair enough. So if you'd like to join the show, 833-99-WORTH. That's 833-999-6784. And while you're doing it, rate us, go to our website, allworthfinancial.com, and take a look at some of our content with our guides and tutorials and educational material that is created all in-house by our great staff here.
We've got some great checklists on retirement issues. We've got checklists that include topics such as retirement tax planning, Social Security, health care.
The health guides have been big. I saw a report this last week that more people have downloaded the health guide checklist than any other thing.
Yeah, we've got a bunch of stuff there. Allworthfinancial.com, right at the Retirement Resources tab, and you'll find all kinds of goodies. Before we go to the calls, because we will take calls, and if you're on hold on the call here, just wait a moment. Every few days in the news now, we're hearing about student debt, which is now at $1.5 trillion.
That's a fair amount of money.
And frankly, every time this comes up, I get angry. And I'm primarily angry. I think our government has done a grave disservice to the younger generation by backing these, which originally they backed, now they're in the business themselves. They just took over the whole business. Essentially, if you're a young person and want to go to college, you get a loan. Doesn't matter if you are, if you can never repay it.
Doesn't matter what you study.
Doesn't matter what you study.
If there's a marketplace for it.
Makes no difference.
Makes no difference, right?
We've seen the education system respond to this. Oh, because look at all these students that are coming. Goodness gracious, so many students.
What do they do?
Supply and demand. There's all this
create
demand.
Create new products or?
Let's increase prices.
Or both.
And I'm not knocking anyone who, just like my good friend is a retired highway patrolman at age 50 with a six-figure pension, and I said, I'm not knocking you. Good for you for doing that. But from a society, it seems it's a lot of money to be paying someone. We can transition someone to a different career, for example. There's a lot of professors, great professors, not knocking any professors, but make a very nice living and do not exactly work 40 hours a week.
Well, we don't know that.
We do know that. I'm not saying all professors.
Okay.
I'm saying the structure is... It's
pretty loose.
It's an interesting structure.
It's pretty loose.
It's an interesting structure. The education system.
So what the problem is, what gets down to it is, the more capital chases a particular product, the more products that are created to absorb that capital, and...
The prices go up.
And give you an example.
There's no more... the trade schools are almost gone,
which
right?
Which is kind of crazy. It's kind of crazy because there should be some...
There are some
trade schools out there, but there should be more. There's nothing wrong with the trades.
You take someone who goes through a 3 or 4 year apprenticeship on plumbing or whatnot, they'll be making a great living. They go study sociology at a university at $50,000 a year. They graduate $200,000 of debt and they can't get a job.
Yeah. So there's a difference.
And the government encouraged the person to study sociology for 4 years without a career path.
So why are you so angry?
Because I see these kids. I feel very fortunate that I've been able to help my kids go through the college and they graduate without these huge debt. But
we work with people in our firm that are relatively recent college graduates.
Yes, and
they tell us what their student loans are.
And
in the 135,000
And we see people come through our... trying to go into retirement. They talk about their kids. Here's the issues they've got with their kids. And here's what this, look at this. So, I mean, if I were a young person coming out of college and I've been out of college for 3, 4, 5 years and I've got the student let, I'd kind of start questioning, how did I get myself into this? Was there another path I could have taken? Was no one there to help coach me down this process? The financial aid, they show you how to sign up for it. They don't show you how to get out of it. And so here's why I brought this up. Roughly 10 years ago, Congress, this is in 2007, Congress created a program that said, hey, look, if you go and work for a government agency or a nonprofit institution and you do this for 10 years, make payments on your debt, continue to make the payments you're supposed to, we will forgive the money in 10 years.
This is called the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program.
There's also something similar within 20 years for everybody.
Yeah, it's a percentage of pay.
Your payments don't have to be the full amortized amount. It could be a percentage of pay. So here we are, 10 years out, right? Whether you think it's a good program, not good program, regardless. 73,000 people have applied for this debt forgiveness as of March 31st of this year. 73,000. Guess how many of those actually had their loans erased? 864. Barely over 1%. And there are these people that they're just doing what they're supposed to be doing, right? 18 years old, still pretty young. Frontal lobe's not developed. Okay. I mean, I hate to say it. They're not full adults. Here, sign on this. Take out hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt.
Borrow this money.
They don't think about consequences. That's not how their brains are wired yet. Then they get out, all this debt, and they say, oh, tell you what. Hey, why don't you come work for the government for 10 years? We're going to forgive it. They did that. They're 10 years in. Barely 1% have had their loans forgiven.
But the reality of the situation, Scott, is that there's too much capital chasing education at this point in time.
We better take go to the phones here. 1-833-99-WORTH is the number. We're in Folsom with a Swanee. A Swanee, you're with Allworth Financial.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Been listening to you since 99. One constant in changing life.
Okay, thank you. 99?
Yeah.
Wow.
Kind of your age, I guess. I'm growing up with you guys. So you guys have grown up much bigger than me. But,
what can we do for you?
I have some IRAs, mostly rollovers from 401ks from my previous jobs. So far, I've been mostly invested in index funds and some equities.
Okay.
It's been doing okay. It's doing me like 8%, but getting older and getting health issues, I'm thinking I should go into more fixed income somewhat.
How much individual equities do you have in there? You said you have index funds and individual equities. How much is individual equities?
50-50, I would think. 50 is index funds and 50% in individual equities.
And how many individual equities do you own?
About 10 of them.
Okay. And no bond whatsoever?
I've been lately going into fixed income, so I have like 10% gone
and
into that. About 10%
of your that. Of your equities, you have no actively managed funds?
No.
So intellectually, whether you realize this or not, what you've decided is that the professionals can't outperform the market, which is why you bought the index funds, but somehow I can outperform the market, which is why you own 10 individual securities.
So you actually have a dichotomy that is conflicted.
Yes.
Extremely conflicted.
I understand. Like, it's more like the companies I like. Well, I don't actively trade, market.
Money managers buy, active money managers buy the companies they like. They don't buy companies they don't like.
Yeah.
No one actively manages a portfolio and says, I don't like that company. I'm going to buy it.
Yeah,
right?
I understand that.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's a secondary. Here's why that's an issue.
That because your portfolio lacks diversification.
Well, and it could be much more risky than the broad stock market.
That is correct. So
that's
a different issue together. So the question is...
Well, it's not a different issue.
Well, the question is, should I put bond in the portfolio?
He's looking at reducing his risk profile, essentially.
By putting bond in the portfolio. And we're saying, start with the easy things to reduce a risk profile in the portfolio first, which is the individual stocks, before you go to the bond.
I'm moving the individual stocks into the bonds.
Okay,
so
all right.
I'll be more into index funds and bonds. And I like to play with them, kind of play.
Okay. That's fine.
Yeah,
I don't actively trade. Most of my stocks are like 10 years.
Not trading is trading. So,
right?
Okay. deciding to stay or to go.
Removing individual stocks.
And then, by the way, there's nothing. I mean, there's lots of people that say, look, 90% of my portfolio, I'm going to have the right kind of allocation. I'm going to but I'm going to take 10% and I'm going to trade it. And I'm going to.
How old are you?
I'm 54.
Okay. So your question was, should you have fixed income in the portfolio? Is that your question?
Yeah. My real question is, so I'm moving to fixed income, so I see bonds. I'm trying to build a bond ladder, but at the same time, I see my brokerage has like a fixed deposit, certificates of deposit, CDs.
Yep.
So I'm wondering if there's a disadvantage or advantage. I see they are slightly higher interest rate, the CDs are, for at least in the terms of 3 to 10 years. So can I use interchangeably or should I go bonds?
Yes, you can. So you can use CDs and treasuries interchangeably. The problem is that the treasuries are actually a little bit easier to trade if you decide to liquidate earlier than the CDs, but you can still liquidate a CD early.
I'm not a big fan of bond ladders if we move outside of treasuries, or CDs are fine too. CD ladders are fine. The challenge is, and here's why, and I'm biased. I remember I had a client who had Ford Motor Company bond, which was an investment grade bond when it was purchased in his portfolio, I think for 10 or 15% of his bond ladder. And when Ford went bankrupt, during the financial crisis. He got pennies on the dollar.
I know, Scott, I agree with you there, but he's comparing treasuries and CDs. Are you not?
Yeah, I'm not doing corporate.
You're not doing corporate. Good. Because I agree with Scott. If you're going to do if you're going to do corporate, you want to use a fund.
Or unless you've got multi-millions where you can do high diversification. Then you need a professional manager on them too.
Yeah,
but sometimes it makes sense to buy CDs in the portfolio, and sometimes it makes sense to buy treasuries in the portfolio. But I wouldn't ladder to 10 years. That's just that's an opinion. I think if you look at the yield curve, you're not getting much more of a premium out of year 2 through 10 than you are in year, and unless you believe interest rates are going to fall significantly, then you would want to stay on the shorter end of that. So academic,
unless there's some small bank that is in need of capital, that are often there. As long as you're FDIC insurance, you don't care.
And that's why that's what you're buying in those. But even then, 10 years is you're not for the amount of premium you're going to receive over a 2-year CD or 2-year Treasury. I don't know if it's worth the risk. Unless, of course, you think now academically, you're correct, and I am.
You have no idea where it's impossible to know where interest rates are going to go.
Correct. So I'm just espousing an opinion of what I believe in the marketplace, which is it's not worth going too long on the bond ladder.
Right. Yeah, that's what I observed. Like I can see the interest rate increasing between, say, a few months to 5 years.
Yeah.
But and then after that, the rate of increase is much lower.
Flat. Yep.
So,
yep.
I haven't gone to 10 years. I've really been in the range of 2 to 5 years.
Yeah, correct. Perfect.
I think it's great.
Perfect. Good idea.
You don't have to worry about any
sometimes when they roll in, you should treat treasuries and CDs as one and the same, right? Except
for the state of, if they're outside of IRAs, they're not taxed in the state you reside in.
Unless it's outside of an IRA. If the rest of the listeners, I said treat treasuries and CDs the same inside of an IRA, but outside of an IRA, you should treat them differently because everything remaining equal, the same rates, treasuries are more attractive because they're tax free in the state of California.
That's right.
State tax free.
State tax free.
Appreciate the call.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks
to
for
you.
Listening. Thank you very 99.
Much. Yeah.
Holy smokes.
That's
Scott had a full head of hair.
I think I did back in 99, did
you,
I?
You were a good looking guy when you were young. Things change.
I don't think anyone ever told me that except for my mother and my wife. But,
things change.
I appreciate that.
Things change. I mean, it's on a relative.
My wife told me to quit joking because I'm bald, I wear glasses now, and I'm short. I'm like, come on. I'm like, babe, you don't have to worry about me. I'm a short, funny-looking, bald guy. And she said, can you not say that about you? She said, you know, I actually find you attractive. And when you say that, you know, I started thinking, maybe I better. I don't want to highlight all my weaknesses to my wife. And she starts focusing on those things. That'd be a real problem.
How'd you get your wife to say she finds you attractive? That's the that's what I'm interested in. What words did you use?
I said, no, those jeans don't make your...
Anyway. I heard, yes.
Okay. And let's continue on in Colorado with John. John, you're with Allworth Financial.
Hey, guys, I appreciate you taking my call.
Thank you,
John. Got a quick
John.
Question for you. So I'm 61 years old. I'll be 62 in the summer. I've got about 50% of my portfolio in one stock. I retired from Procter & Gamble. And I'm wondering, it's an ESOP. I've got about 18,000 shares. And I'm wondering at what point should I start moving that out of P&G and diversifying my portfolio?
Are there any restrictions on that?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
What do you think?
But I do get a 3.25 dividend, you know, every year on it. And as you've watched it recently, it's really picked up pretty aggressively here of late.
When did you, how long have you had it in there?
33 years.
So here's one way to think about it. If you had, let's say you retired today and had cash and you went to a financial advisor and the financial advisor said, let's put 50% of your portfolio in Procter & Gamble stock and then we'll diversify the rest. What would you say?
Yeah, I'd probably say no.
Yeah, of course.
Right? you'd say to that advisor, you're an absolute, what are you talking about?
And I think part of the, so diversification is not designed to increase returns. In fact, it won't increase returns, right? Because you've diversified enough, you're going to get the broad market. But what it does do is reduce risk. And the older we get, the more close we are to retirement. And then when we're in retirement, most of us are much more concerned about protecting what we have than getting wealthier.
We worked a lot with telecom employees, and we go back to 1999, and I think of Lucent Technologies, MCI WorldCom, Enron.
I'll give you a story.
Pacific Gas and Electric.
Pacific Gas and Electric, utility, you know, widow and orphan stock, done well, high dividend. It used to have a high dividend. That stock was roughly $70 a share because of the California wildfires. You know, it fell down to, it was under $10. I mean, it's in bankruptcy now. Who knows what it's going to pop out at?
So the answer to the question is, John, it would make a lot of sense to diversify away from that, and especially being in it's in an ESOP now, but you can move it to an IRA. And inside an IRA, you can buy anything you want. In fact, you should move it.
But there's also, you might be able to take advantage of some net unrealized appreciation.
Which is a form of the tax code that allows you to pull the dollars out of the ESOP and only pay taxes on the
cost basis. So you might say, let's have some of these shares sent directly to me. I'll pay the ordinary income taxes on the cost basis.
And then any of the gain after 12 months, you recognize it as capital gains. And it's called net unrealized appreciation. And it is
I don't believe you need to wait a year. I think you use long-term capital gain day one.
I stand corrected. So have you heard of this net unrealized appreciation, John?
I have.
Okay. That's a technique I would look at.
Yeah.
But most certainly I would look at diversifying away from 50%. How big is the overall portfolio?
Probably about 3.5.
I'm sorry, say that again?
3.5 million.
All right. Yeah.
And here's the hard part. Right? The company's been part of your life. You spent 30 plus years there, right?
The emotional part, right?
Right. It's part of you. You're part of,
Scott?
Just let me finish. This is what's going on in his head, right?
Okay.
So it's been part of your life. It's what got you here today. It's really the only career you've known. It's the only business you've really known intimately. And there's this emotional attachment to it.
100% correct.
Right? But we're at a chapter now that this is about how do we make sure that John and John's family, that this retirement stage can be well-funded. And at this point, let's do everything in our power to reduce whatever risk we have out there that can sideline. Because John's not going back to work, I don't think, right?
John?
No, I'm going to retire in 3 years.
Okay, so you're still employed?
Yes.
Okay, I was misunderstood that you were...
I'd still do it.
Now, not there, but I'm still employed.
Oh, got it. You're no longer employed there.
I'd still diversify.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
And you also, it isn't necessarily a financial rule, but it happens in life anyway. Whenever you sell a stock, it goes up in value the next day. And if you buy it, it goes down. That's just what happens.
But you don't have to do 100% of it. But Scott, you've diversified some of your risk off a company that you've been with.
Yes, no question.
Your career, as have I. Even in our own small company.
And the challenge is we've seen people sitting across the table from us that now we're trying to figure out how do we make the most of their situation because they were, and these were great companies they're involved in.
Right.
I mean, look at PG&E, a utility. I mean, they're monopolies, right? Mm-hmm. Who would think that the stock price would fall 70% and eliminate the dividend? Heck, recently was the Kraft.
Kraft.
I mean, look at GE.
Look at GE.
Why are we even going to these other examples?
We could spend an hour going through all the examples.
I mean, that fell almost 90%.
Yeah.
That was GE.
But John knew the answer. You knew the answer, John, when you called.
Yeah. I've been resident to not to pull the trigger.
Yeah, but listen, it hasn't hurt you.
No, it's actually. Yeah, it's kind of helped.
Yeah.
You know, it's over 100 on Friday. So.
So remember, the stock doesn't know you own it. It is just an asset, right? And the check we always go through is, would I buy this today? And if the answer is no, I wouldn't buy any more of it, or would I buy what I own today? And if the answer is no, I wouldn't take 50% of my net worth and put it in the stock, then you shouldn't own it.
Yeah.
That's why we use the example of you went to an advisor and they said 50% in there. You shouldn't own it. And I do that with everything. I do that with any of my real estate holdings. I do that with cars. I go through that mental with myself, right?
Even the family members. Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't do it with the family members. That's bad. I know that much. So appreciate the call.
All right, John. We wish you well.
Thanks, guys. Yeah. Appreciate the help.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know these are not easy decisions, and it's just so it's amazing
he's
how
much we get. He's got $3.5 million in his ESOP. That's a pretty easy decision.
Well, it's easy for me.
No, it's easy for him, too. It's $3.5 million in his retirement plan.
But still, why is that making an easy decision? Because here's what goes on. You can think, well, I've got $3.5 million. And they say don't have anything invested you can't afford to lose. I could actually afford to lose some, so maybe I should continue to be overweighted and take that risk. Although, if you look at the last decade, I don't think Procter & Gamble's next outperformed the S&P amount.
But the reason,
if it has at all, I don't know.
I mean, but he asked the question, which means that he's ready for the move.
Well, as you said, he already knew the answer before.
Yeah, he was looking for some validation.
Yeah, and some other people to get in his corner. Because as soon as he sells it, it's going to go up in price. And then his coworker's going to say, John, you big idiot. And if the stock price is significantly higher a few years from now, they say, John, you really made a big mistake. That's the challenge of it.
That's why I don't talk to coworkers.
Well, that's what happens
in companies. There's this.
Oh yeah,
this
group think. There's no question about it. It's not necessarily healthy.
And management. I had a relative call me recently. He said our CEO. We were on a conference call. And he talked about how well this stock's going to do, and that we all should consider.
Of course,
buying
he's
it.
Going to.
And I said, of course he did that. And he said, well, what do you think? And I looked at the stock. And I'm like, oh, I wouldn't buy this dog.
And if you look at that CEO's tenure, that guy didn't even know what he was doing. But I think, you know, your point of looking at GE, that company was, in 2000, was known as, it was highly diversified. Some people said it was an S&P 500 equivalent. It was roughly $60 a share. That stock fell to what, 6 or 7 before it had a little life bounce?
It was probably one of the most widely diversified U.S.-based companies in terms of its footprint across industries.
And if you went to retirement and kept 50% of your portfolio in that thing, you'd be changing your standard of living.
Yeah.
There's no question. Well, unfortunately, that is all the time we have in today's program. Again, as Pat had asked before, if you listen to via podcast, just go and give us a rating, please. Give us a review. We'd greatly appreciate that. We're back here next weekend, the same time. Hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend, the rest of your day, whatever it might be. See you soon.
This program has been brought to you by Allworth Financial, a registered investment advisory firm. Any ideas presented during this program are not intended to provide specific financial advice. You should consult your own financial advisor, tax consultant, or estate planning attorney to conduct your own due diligence.